Today on Enduring Word with David Guzik, pastor of Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara.
The fictional excuse of this prophet in this play-acting story tragically becomes a reality in the lives of many people. And in the same way, when the prisoner was gone, he was gone. Even as the fictional prisoner escaped, so many opportunities escape us in the Christian life. It's gone. The prisoner's gone. You had your opportunity to fulfill your duty, but now it's gone. Sure, you were busy here and there, but you didn't do what God wanted you to do.
God has different tasks for each Christian to handle in their lifetime. These opportunities to share God's love are all around us every day, and sometimes we miss them. Pastor David's message today is that we must be vigilant about seeking out these areas where the kingdom can grow. Many times when those opportunities pass, they will not come again. Today, we can start afresh by asking God to make it clear the possibilities to connect with someone and share the greatest news ever. Now, here's Pastor David with today's edition of Enduring Word.
You look at the Israelite army. Looks like two little flocks of goats on the hillside. They look like lambs to the slaughter, don't they? It doesn't look good for Israel. Then a man of God came and spoke to the king of Israel and said, by the way, Elisha? No, another anonymous man of God. A man of God came and spoke to the king of Israel and said, thus says the Lord, because the Syrians have said, the Lord is God of the hills, but he is not God of the valleys. Therefore, I will deliver all this great multitude into your hand, and you shall know that I am the Lord. Now, I want you to notice this. When Ben-Hadad came back again to avenge the loss that he had the year before, he came back with an overwhelming force. He didn't want to risk another humiliation. And it also makes you wonder if Ben-Hadad really took this business of gods of hills and valleys very seriously. Because he said, our God may be the God of the valleys, but we're going to bring an awfully big army with us also. But at least some of the Syrians really believe this. That the Lord is the God of the hills, he's not the God of the valleys. And God says that because of this, I'm going to deliver all this great multitude into the hands of the Israelites who are vastly outnumbered. Now I want you to notice something here. God took the bad theology of the Syrians as a personal insult. We don't often think about that, do we? That bad theology insults God. We often, as a matter of fact, think just the opposite. We almost think, God's a big God, and he doesn't really care what people think about him. What, you think God's like on some insecurity trip, and he's worried about what people think about him? No, that's not the matter at all. Our God is a great God, and when lies are told about him, it bothers him. When we hold and choose to hold in our mind wrong beliefs about God, it insults him. He has every reason to believe that you don't understand him. You don't care to understand him. It's just like this. You wonder how God would say, you think I'm a God of grace, but not of righteousness, instead of the hills and the valleys thing. You think I'm a God of a comfort, but not of power. Our wrong understanding of God can be a grave insult of him. It can take away from his glory and his majesty, and it never adds to it. God resented their blasphemy, and he was determined to punish it. He was going to show them, my power is everywhere. Don't you call me a God of the hills. I'm going to show you that my power is present in the valleys as well. So, I hope Ahab was feeling better about this with his little two flocks of goats there on the hillside, so to speak, but a message from the prophet of God. Now, let me remind you of something before we look at verse 29. Do you think that for some reason there had been great spiritual revival in the life of Ahab? No. Again, we always want to think that if God saves, if God blesses, it's because, some leader is so spiritual, and that's why God is doing it. Personally, leaders love to cultivate that idea. If God's really blessing, it's because the leader is so spiritual. I want you to think that, of anything I'm associated with, that if God's blessing it, well, of course, it's because I'm so spiritual. And isn't that why God blesses it? But, it's crazy, isn't it? God's blessing or the perceived lack of blessing may have nothing to do with the leader. Nothing. You can't make rules about such things. You can't say, well, all the good ones are blessed and all the bad ones are cursed, or the other way around. You can make no laws about this. In these things, many times the ways of God are past finding out. Some of the most godly pastors I know, I can think of some right now, I can think through the business cards in my mind right now, some incredibly godly pastors, man, they just struggle. And I don't know why. I wish I had their character. I wish I had their integrity. I wish I had their godliness. And yet I see, and man, their ministry is just a struggle. And then I know other pastors who seem to have great success, one field or another. And I look and I just say, man, you know, what's going on with that? Lord, how are you blessing that? But I want you to know, this is carnal thinking. When we think, well, you know, God's blessing all the good boys and he's penalizing all the bad boys. You can't figure it out that way. You just cannot figure it out that way. And so we see God showing great mercy and blessing to Ahab, who was an unrighteous, ungodly man, but he's doing it for his name's sake and for his people's sake. He's not doing it for Ahab's sake, but for his name's sake and for his people's sake. All right, now verse 29. And they encamped opposite each other for 7 days. So it was on the seventh day that the battle was joined, and the children of Israel killed 100,000 foot soldiers of the Syrians in 1 day. But the rest fled to Aphek, into the city. Then a wall fell on 27,000 of the men who were left. And Ben-Hadad fled and went to the city into an inner chamber. I think this is wonderful, because this was clearly a miracle, yet it was a miracle working through the existing Israeli army, which was like a flock of goats compared to the size of the Syrian army. God wanted to show that, as unlikely as it seemed, he could work through this outwardly weak and ineffective instrument. But then God threw in a little bit of the supernatural after that. After the great victory on the battlefield, God moved another extraordinary where he's like pushing over that wall on the 27,000 Syrians that had escaped to Aphek. And he really wanted to show, look, I'm not just going to let you think that Israel has beat you. I have beat you as well. And so there was a tremendous, tremendous victory for Israel. Again, not just in the hills, but in the valleys as well. Verse 31. Then his servant said to him, look, now we have heard that the kings of the house of Israel are merciful kings. These are the advisors and the assistants to Ben-Hadad. We've heard that the kings of the house of Israel are merciful kings. Please let us put sackcloth around our waists and ropes around our heads and go out to the king of Israel. Perhaps he will spare your life. So they wore sackcloth around their waists and put ropes around their heads and came to the king of Israel and said, your servant Ben-Hadad says, please let me live. And he said, is he alive? He is still my brother. Now the men were watching closely to see whether a sign of mercy would come from him. And they quickly grasped at his word and said, your brother Ben-Hadad. So he said, go bring him. Then Ben-Hadad came out to him. He had him come up into the chariot. So Ben-Hadad said to him, the cities which my father took from your father, I will restore. And you may set up marketplaces for yourself in Damascus, as my father did in Samaria. Then Ahab said, I will send you away with this treaty. So he made a treaty with him and sent him away. Isn't it fascinating? Not long before this, Ben-Hadad spoke severe threats against Ahab and all the kingdom of Israel. Remember that whole, you know, God do so to me and more if my servants can each get a handful of dust from the city of Samaria and all that kind of business. Now, he humbled himself as much as he could to win mercy and favor from the unexpectedly triumphant king of Israel. By the way, I don't want to over-spiritualize this too much, but I think it's a wonderful thing for sinners to come to God, the king, with the same manner as Ben-Hadad came to Ahab. Come with sincerity, come with humility, come with surrender, come with earnestness, and come close, I love this, watching to see whether any sign of mercy would come to them. I love that. The idea of a sinner coming to God, humbly, surrendered, and then just looking to God, are you going to show me any sign of mercy? Do you have a sign of mercy for me? And of course, God will show this kind of mercy. But unfortunately, Ahab should not have shown mercy to the king of Syria. That's not what God wanted him to do. You see, Ahab felt a kinship towards this pagan king with these very pagan ideas of God. Perhaps Ahab wanted Ben-Hadad and Syria's friendship and protection against other political alliances that were building around the world. If that's the case, he was looking for friends in the wrong places, and he had no business making the treaty that's described there in verses 33 and 34. The victory was the Lord's. The victory didn't belong to Ahab. Ahab is negotiating away the Lord's victory, and I don't think the Lord's going to be happy with that. So here, he's doing what he should not do, but now we come here to verse 35 and see our next anonymous prophet going to speak here to Ahab. Look at it here. Now, a certain man of the sons of the prophets said to his neighbor by the word of the Lord, "Strike me, please." And the man refused to strike him. Stop. You got to put a little pause right here. Some things in the Bible are just kind of weird. Okay, we admit that. This is one of those just kind of weird passages. We're introduced to a prophet who goes up to, you can just imagine, knocking on the door. Hello, you know, hi. I suppose maybe this other guy is another one of the sons of the prophets. We don't know for certain, but maybe it's sort of implied in the text. Hi, can you do me a favor? Can you strike me, please? No, I'm not going to do that. Now, I want you to notice again, this is another anonymous prophet, another anonymous man of God who's here busy. Do you think God is trying to get a message through to us here? Elijah, Elisha, we're not alone. God had many others, and God would work through many others. We have this tendency, don't we? We look at ourselves, we look at the people around us in our circle, and we think, well, that's where God's working, nowhere else. No, listen, God has many people who can do many great works beyond our own vision, and we should be thankful for it. But anyway, back to this weird prophet. Strike me, please, he says. Now, we're assuming, and I think we have reason to assume this, that this was directed by God. You see, this prophet that's mentioned here in verse 35, he needed an injury to show to King Ahab. And I guess it's kind of hard to hit yourself hard enough to make an injury. So he came over and said, strike me, please. What happened when his neighbor refused? Verse 36, it's weird. Then he said to him, "Because you have not obeyed the voice of the Lord, surely, as soon as you depart from me, a lion shall kill you." And as soon as he left him, a lion found him and killed him. Wow. All right, if you want me to figure all this out for you, I can't. All right, all I can tell you is that presumably this neighbor was not just another man in the kingdom of Israel. The implication is that he was a fellow member of the sons of the prophets, and that he should have been sensitive to what God was doing, and maybe that the prophet prevailed upon him even more than what's in the text. He should have known better. It's not so clear in the New King James Version, which I'm reading to you from, but it's more clear in some other translations. Let me read to you, for example, from the New Revised Standard Version. It says, "A certain member of the company of the prophets said to another." In other words, the idea is, it's another of his own company. So it's not like he's just asking, it's not like he's going to an anonymous man on the street, "Hi, would you strike me, please?" No. Oh, well, then a lion's going to eat you. No, that's not it. He's going up to a fellow prophet, one who presumably should have this sensitivity to the things of God, one who should know, my fellow prophet isn't going to come up and ask me to do such a weird thing unless it's from God, and at least I should do is I should pray about it and seek God about it before refusing him. And because he wouldn't seek God, because he didn't listen to the Lord at all on this, well, we have to say, I mean, the lion came out and ate him, and this doesn't seem to be a typical work here, but it just seems to be something that happened on this occasion. In any regard, verse 37, I like how this follows here. "And he found another man and said, 'Strike me, please.' And the man struck him, inflicting a wound." We're happy about this. You know, you'd hate to see this go through five or six people until he found somebody who was actually willing to hit him. Verse 38. "Then the prophet departed and waited for the king by the road and disguised himself with a bandage over his eyes." So you get the picture here. This weird prophet who wanted somebody to hit him, he needed the injury to play act something for King Ahab in the following verses. So here he's laying by the side of the road. He's got a bandage around his head. Presumably there's some blood involved, but you get the picture. All right, now verse 39. Now, as the king passed by, he cried out to the king and said, "Your servant went out into the midst of the battle, and there a man came over and brought a man to me and said, 'Guard this man. If by any means he is missing, your life shall be for his life, or else you shall pay a talent of silver.' Well, while your servant was busy here and there, he was gone." Then the king of Israel said to him, "So shall your judgment be. You yourself have decided it." Okay, so you understand the story here, right? The story is, I was responsible to guard this man's life, but I was unfaithful in it. You have to love the line in verse 40. "While your servant was busy here and there, he was gone." A suitably vague description, right? Well, you know, I just had a few things to do and it kind of got in the way of me guarding this guy. And well, before I knew it, I looked up and he was gone. What do you know? You know, no real reason, just I was busy here and there, and oh, I let the guy escape. He was unfaithful to the job that he was given to do, and the guilty man's excuse, his only excuse, was that I was busy here and there, which was no excuse at all. He should have paid attention to the job that he had to do. I mean, listen, it's an important responsibility to guard a prisoner on the field of battle, but he didn't take the responsibility seriously. I find that this prophet's made-up story with the fictional excuse becomes real in the life of many people, especially in many ministers of the gospel. Let me read you a quote from G. Campbell Morgan on this. He says, "If a man is called to preach the word and becomes busy over 100 things other than that of his central work, and so loses the opportunity to preach, his failure is complete. That which is our God-appointed work, we must do. If we fail in that, the fact that we have been busy here and there, doing all sorts of other things, is of no avail." I wonder if that's how it's going to be with some of us. You know, when we stand before the Lord in judgment, not judgment for heaven or hell, but judgment for reward. Judgment where we stand before Jesus Christ. And he says, I want to know what you did with your life. And Jesus said, you know, I had something I wanted you to do. I had a calling. I gave you gifts. I give you a purpose in this life. Did you do it? And we said, I was busy here and there. That's not enough. You know, God has a purpose for you in this world. He has gifts. He has talents. He has calling that he's given you. The fictional excuse of this prophet in this play-acting story tragically becomes a reality in the lives of many people. And in the same way, when the prisoner was gone, he was gone. Even as the fictional prisoner escaped, so many opportunities escape us in the Christian life. It's gone. The prisoner's gone. You had your opportunity to fulfill your duty, but now it's gone. Sure, you were busy here and there, but you didn't do what God wanted you to do. Now, when Ahab hears the story, what's his reaction there in verse 40? He says, hey, so shall your judgment be. You yourself have decided it. You see, in the prophet's story, he was unfaithful in guarding something that was entrusted to him. And Ahab rightly judged that he should have been held responsible for it. You know, Ahab saying, so what? You want to whine to me now about the injury that you have? You know, you deserve it. You were given a trust, you were given a duty, and you were unfaithful to it. All right, now are we ready for the great finale here? Verse 41. And he hastened to take the bandage away from his eyes, and the king recognized him as one of the prophets. Now, right there, it tells you why he wanted to disguise himself as a soldier. If he just had his normal appearance, the king would have said, that's one of those troublesome prophets, you ride straight by. But he could only get the king's attention by disguising himself. And so you can imagine the king's horror as the guy rips off the bandage and the king, it's one of those prophets that I've been avoiding. So what happens? And he said to him, thus says the Lord, because you have let slip out of your hand a man whom I appointed to utter destruction, therefore your life shall go for his life and your people for his people. So the king of Israel went to his house sullen and displeased and came to Samaria. God intended that Ben-Hadad should be utterly destroyed, but he also intended that it be done by the hand of the army of Israel. Now, let me ask you this. Did God want Ben-Hadad judged with death? Yes. Then why didn't God just do it himself? He certainly is capable of doing it, isn't he? Yes. But God was also interested in the way that death came about, and he called Ahab and the army of Israel to execute this righteous judgment against this pagan king who had shed the blood of so many of the people of the kingdom of Israel. But Ahab was more interested in making friends with Ben-Hadad than he was in doing what God wanted him to do. It's a painful experience in our Christian life to realize that when we don't deal with things the way that they should, they come back and get us. When Saul doesn't deal with Agag, it comes back and it gets him. You know, when David doesn't deal with the things he should be dealing with, it comes back and it gets him. And here King Ahab didn't deal with Ben-Hadad the way that he should have. And now he will pay a great price for it. There's a great temptation always in our walk before God to simply be careless, to not follow through on the things that God speaks to us about to do. Maybe to do it halfway. You know, God told the Israelites to go and fight against the Syrians. And did they fight? Yes, they did. They even won a great victory. But they stopped short of the complete victory that God wanted them to have. And this is a great temptation for us. You know, we don't want to stay out of the battle completely. But on the other hand, we're oftentimes very content with something short of complete victory. That was Ahab's sin. Are you struck there by the very last sentence in the same way I am? Verse 43. So the king of Israel went to his house sullen and displeased and came to Samaria. Well, yeah, he was sullen. He was displeased. Was he repentant? No. He had the sorrow of being a sinner and knowing the consequences of his sin without having sorrow for the sin itself. And so we'll see what happens with Ahab in the last two chapters here. But it's a tragic thing that's going to come before him. All right, just a couple applications for us to grab away from this great chapter, 1 Kings chapter 20, before we conclude. Number one, we see how God used these anonymous prophets. Isn't that wonderful? I mean, even when you have these bright, shining lights, and maybe you feel like that sometime in your own Christian service of the Lord, you know, you think that there's bright, shining lights in God's kingdom, you know, and those are the ones that, listen, God uses the anonymous just as well. Sometimes even greater, you must admit that. So here, God uses these anonymous ones. The other thing we have to admit is that here we see in this chapter that God is the God of everywhere, of every circumstance, of every position, not just the hills, not just the valleys, but of everything. And we need to regard him as so. But the third thing we learn, and the final, is the great importance of fulfilling what God has given us to do, of finishing the race. It's not enough to go part way and then quit. If God has called you to do it, then you fulfill it with all of your strength. And beware of the temptation of almost finishing, of almost completing the work. I would say that you would think, listen, we killed, what was it, 125,000 or something like that Syrians. Isn't that enough? No, because you didn't kill the one I wanted you to also, Ben-Hadad. Something for us to learn, to not stop short of the full victory that the Lord would want to give us.
For many of us, studying the Bible is a part of our everyday lives. There seems to always be those sections of Scripture that are difficult to understand. What did Jesus really mean when he said, "And if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you"? Was Jesus literally telling us to disfigure our bodies? Of course not. We know that's not true. So what does it mean? This is where God has used men like Pastor David Guzik in the writing of commentaries. Pastor David has written numerous commentaries throughout the Bible. In fact, you can find commentary on the entire New Testament and most of the Old Testament at enduringword.com. These commentaries are available digitally at the website and even in mobile format. Concise thoughts about the history, context, and author make these commentaries a valuable resource as you seek to know Jesus more. We encourage you to log on to enduringword.com and select the book and chapter you're currently studying. Or you can purchase a copy of Pastor David's commentary for your Kindle or even a printed copy. Simply log on to enduringword.com and select books from the main menu. Another great option from Pastor David is his book, Standing in Grace. This book details the fact that those who belong to him are not only saved by grace, they stand in grace. Again, for all these wonderful resources and more, log on to enduringword.com. Well, that concludes our time together today. Please place a marker in your Bibles and make plans to join us again for the next edition of Enduring Word Radio.